you very much. I'm delighted to be here with you. I believe that in your packets you have some charts and data, and since I'm now CBO director, I can't go anywhere without data. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the budget in the short term, and then a little bit about the budget in the long term. And I'll give you the Cliff Notes version first. Over the past several years, that is, if you look from 2003 to 2007, or over the past four years or so, a surprisingly disproportionate share of the improvement in the federal budget has come from the corporate income tax. And I think it's quite interesting to explore why that has occurred. And then, as you look out over the long term, the nation's fiscal problem has been largely misdiagnosed. You often hear talk of the coming retirement of the baby boomers and the tidal wave that's associated with that, and aging does indeed impose some burden on the budget. But by far the more important factor affecting the long-term fiscal outlook facing the nation is the rate at which healthcare costs grow compared to income per capita, which exerts a substantially larger effect on our fiscal outlook over the long term than the aging of the baby boomers. So that's the short version. Now let's go into the details. This first chart here, which has budget outcomes for 2003 and 2006, and actually we don't need to say baseline budget projections for 07 anymore, that's reality. So we didn't update the chart, my apologies about that. Shows you that if you look from 2003 to 2006, the budget deficit fell from $378 billion to $248 billion, or as a share of the economy, from 3.5% of the economy to 1.9%. That improvement of 1.6% of GDP came entirely on the revenue side, because outlays actually went up as a share of GDP between 2003 and 2006. Revenues rose by more than the increase in outlays, and so the deficit fell by basically a percent and a half, 1.6% of the economy. And here's the thing that I find shocking. 1.5% of GDP increase in the corporate income tax collected between 2003 and 2006. In 2003, revenue collected from the corporate income tax was 1.2% of the economy. In 2006, it was 2.7%. I actually remember someone in being introduced. I was at Brookings in 2003. Many of you may know that Marty Feldstein and others have proposed a Social Security reform plan, which partially involves a set of calculations involving the corporate income tax. And I remember co-authoring a piece critiquing Mr. Feldstein or Professor Feldstein for assuming that the corporate income tax revenue collection could ever double as being completely absurd. Reality has turned out to be, now of course that proposal didn't actually take place, so it wasn't, the doubling that we actually observed was not because of Marty Feldstein's proposal, but nonetheless, history does show that the corporate income tax moved substantially. Over the past year, and I'll return to the corporate income tax in a second, over the past year, between 2006 and 2007, the story's a little bit different. Throughout 2007, we saw a rapid deceleration in the rate at which corporate income tax collections were occurring. And the improvement in the budget deficit between 2006 and 2007, where the budget deficit fell from $248 billion to $163 billion, was a more complicated story. It involved both a small reduction in outlays and an increase in revenues, which you can see being coming more from the individual income tax than from the corporate income tax, and the corporate income tax actually stayed constant at 2.7% of the economy in 2007. So I find this really fascinating. A lot of the popular discussion about the budget improvement over the past 4 or 5 years tells a somewhat different story in which, well, there are lots of stories out there, but not so concentrated in the corporate income tax. And when you look at these numbers, and you want to figure out why the budget deficit improved, you really do have to then dig into why corporate income revenue went from 1.2 to 2.7% of the economy. Now, one reason is that corporate profits as the share of GDP increased, and by a simple accounting, that can account for about 1 out of the 1.5 percentage point increase in corporate income tax revenue. That increase in the corporate profit share occurred to some small degree because wages and salaries and labor compensation share declined, but more because interest payments, which are another component of national income, declined. So a big part of this appears to be a shift in the form of the return to capital away from basically tax-preferred debt and towards corporate profits, which then drove up corporate income tax revenue. But I would say no one really understands why the corporate profit share rose so much. There have been some explanations that perhaps it's related to Sarbanes-Oxley and reporting and what have you. But I would note that the corporate profit share rose not just in the United States, but it rose basically across continental Europe. It rose in Japan and in other countries. So that accounting story presumably leaves something to be desired. And we are spending some time at CBO trying to figure out why the corporate profit share did shift and whether it is likely to be a more permanent thing or whether it's simply a cyclical phenomenon somewhat disproportionate to past economic cycles, but it is normal for corporate profits as a share of the economy to rise during an economic recovery. It just happened to a larger degree than anyone would have predicted during this cycle. So that's a puzzle that I would note. Recently, Chairman Bernanke was asked about the same thing, and I don't know how I should describe my reaction, but he couldn't explain it either, so at least we're not too far behind the ball. And it's something that I would welcome further discussion on with you. If you look out over the next decade, we have a set of baseline projections, which are shown in the next chart, in which the deficit is eliminated by 2012. But that assumes a variety of things embodied in current law that basically no one believes will actually occur, including that the alternative minimum tax will take over the tax code, or increasingly take over the tax code, that all of the 2001 and 2003 tax provisions will expire as scheduled at the end of 2010, that discretionary spending will decline significantly as a share of the economy, and a variety of other things that whenever I describe them, people laugh at me. Nonetheless, that is current law, and that's what we are supposed to, for budget scoring and budgetary baseline purposes, project, and that's what you see on that next chart. If you instead adopt, as you flip the page, a set of alternative assumptions in which the alternative minimum tax is reformed so that it does not take over an increasing share of the tax code, in which the 2001 and 2003 tax provisions are continued past their scheduled expiration, and in which discretionary spending basically keeps pace with GDP growth, you wind up on that bottom path in which the deficit deteriorates over the next decade, and deficits in the 2-4% of the economy range are the projected outcome. So the budget outlook for the next decade or so is very dependent on policy choices that are made. Somewhere perhaps even in between the baseline set of projections and that alternative path that I showed you. So that's the short term and, I guess, the medium term. I wanted to turn to the more important part and where I'm trying to focus a lot of CBO's activities, which is the longer term fiscal problem facing the nation. As you can see from this chart on Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid, even over the next decade, the rate at which the cost of our healthcare programs go up is significantly higher than Social Security. Social Security is the dark blue bar. Over the next decade, under our projections, it's projected to rise in cost by about 0.5% of the economy, from 4.2% to 4.8% of the economy. During the same time period, Medicare and the federal share of Medicaid projected to rise from 4.6% to 5.9%. So that's 1.3% of GDP increase. It's twice as much as the rise in Social Security. Right there, we should already start to wonder a little bit about the popular perception that this is all demographically related and that the key problem is aging, because the aging shows up in Social Security. There's clearly something else going on that's driving up healthcare costs even more. As you look out further over time, that conclusion becomes even more pronounced. And what I'll now describe is a set of projections that we just came out with yesterday, that will be embodied in our long-term fiscal outlook that will be released next month, and that we believe represent an innovation in the way long-term health projections are undertaken. One of the reasons that aging has been, if anything, exaggerated as a share of the overall fiscal problem facing the nation is that existing official projections of healthcare cost growth in the future assume a very significant slowdown in the rate at which healthcare costs grow compared to historical levels for reasons that are not entirely clear to me. And as bad as the picture is of many projections that you have seen officially, those projections do assume a slowdown that may not be consistent with current law. And so let me try to describe that in a little bit more detail. If you look over the past four decades or so, which is this chart spending on healthcare spending has more than tripled as a share of the economy from under 5% of GDP then to more than 15% today. And you can see that rise occurring in the two public programs, Medicare and Medicaid, and in the rest of the health system. So I think it's a fairly safe projection. Someone told me that you should always pick a number or a date, but never both. And unfortunately, I don't really have that flexibility anymore. But I think it's safe to say that it would be reasonable to project continued increases in this share over time. And the key question is how to do that projection. So a natural starting point is to just look at the rate at which healthcare costs have been growing in the past. And that's the next table. And in particular, the way these things are typically measured is something called the excess cost growth rate, which does not necessarily mean excessive cost growth. Let me just immediately say that. It is just a technical term. Excess cost growth means the cost per beneficiary, whatever that is, let's say it's 4% a year going up, minus the rate at which income per capita is rising. So basically, it's measuring cost per beneficiary compared to income per capita. And what you see in the bottom row there is the average excess cost growth rate over the past three decades. And we start in 1975 because that allows time for Medicare and Medicaid, which were created in the mid-1960s, to kind of get up and running. And what you see is that basically those growth rates are all in the 2 to 2.5% range for Medicare, for Medicaid, and for the rest of the health system. One observation that follows directly from that, by the way, is that one would generally expect the rate at which healthcare costs grow in Medicare and Medicaid and the rest of the health system to track each other fairly closely over long periods of time, in part because doctors are seeing the same patients and practice norms are affecting the overall health system. The public and private parts of our health system are integrated to such a large degree that it would be unusual looking over some historical period to see significant divergences in those two rates. However, looking out over the future, as I'll describe, unless we change federal policy, a divergence may open up. In other words, federal policy changes in the past have been necessary to achieve this result of healthcare costs tracking each other fairly closely over long periods of time in different parts of the health system. Now, some people look at this table and they also say, well, okay, it's fine to jump off of some historical average, but you know, since 1990, healthcare costs have been growing slower than they were before that, and I showed that to you in the table, and that's correct. But our view, for two reasons, was it's better to take the longer-term average. And the first reason was many of the things that happened in the 1990s may well have involved a one-time shift in the level of costs, which over some short period of time will show up as a slower growth rate, rather than a change in the underlying trend. So for example, expansion of managed care, we believe most of the evidence suggests, helped to reduce the level of cost, but it may not have affected the underlying growth rate over a long period of time. During that shift, it shows up as a slowdown in the cost growth rate. But secondly, if you look at the next chart, these things bounce around from year to year a lot. And that next chart shows you how bouncy this excess cost growth is, which underscores the benefit of taking an average over a long period of time. And it also, to our eye at least, and formal econometrics also underscore this, doesn't seem to display any discernible trend, which also suggests just taking the average over that long period of time would be a good thing to do. And then a final point to note about this is, as you can see, On average, things tend to track each other, Medicare, Medicaid, the rest of the health system. But there are times when Medicare grows faster, there are times when Medicaid grows faster, there are times when the rest of the health system grows faster. So they're not perfectly correlated, they're just connected over long periods of time. Now, one way of projecting the future is just to take those historical growth rates and say, okay, that's what the growth rate will be in the future. We're done. And that's a nice, easy thing to do, and I show it to you in the next graph. There is, however, one problem, which is that by the end of 75 years, healthcare is more than 100% of GDP, which is a little unfortunate and causes a little discomfort in some circles for reasons that I don't understand. Furthermore, one would expect, even again, conceptually, what we're trying to do here is show the implications of current federal policy. But one would expect, even in the absence of federal policy changes, as all of you in the room know, as the share of healthcare costs in GDP and in consumption rise, there will likely be increasing pressure from employers, from households, from state governments, which we are not supposed to keep their policy fixed, to try to undertake things like utilization management and slower adoption of technology and changes in practice norms and changes in cost sharing and lots of other steps to slow the growth rate. And conceptually, therefore, we want to allow that kind of thing to occur even while we're keeping federal policy fixed. So it is important to realize lots of things that we put forward from CBO are not a prediction of the future. They are instead a scenario in which the implications of unchanged federal policy are explored. And I would include these health projections in that way. There are lots of things that we show, you know, fiscal projections showing debt to GDP going to 400% of the economy. Pretty safe bet to say that'll never happen, because trying to sell an additional dollar of debt when you're already at 400 or 500% of GDP is not going to be the easiest thing in the world. Similarly, it is not going to be the case that federal policy won't change. So this is not a prediction of the future, but conceptually the goal here is to say what would happen if we didn't. So what we did is we allowed the rest of the health system to respond to increasing cost pressure and to have some of that spill over onto Medicare and Medicaid because of changes in practice norms and technological adoption and what have you. And I could describe that in more detail, but the result is shown on the next chart. And the result of that is that after tripling between 1960 and today, we project that total healthcare spending will more than double again between today and 2035. And spending on Medicare and Medicaid, which is 4% of the economy today, will triple by 2050 to more than 12% of the economy then. So I'd be happy to describe those things in more detail, but those are our central projections. The next chart just shows you where we wind up relative to some other norms. I'm actually going to skip over that chart and go to this next chart, which shows our projections relative to the Medicare trustees. The Medicare trustees take those historical growth rates that I showed you of about 2 or 2.5%, and they assume that in the future, between year 25 and year 75, that growth rate will be 1%. Those have been the dominant sets of official projections that are used in discussions thus far. And again, it's not clear to me why we should assume 1% automatically in the future in the absence of federal policy changes. And as a result of that, even though we track fairly closely over the next couple decades, by the end of the projection window, our new projections are significantly above, about 50% higher than the trustees' assumptions, which again assume this average 1% excess cost growth in the future. The next chart shows you what I think is a very important point coming back to demographics. It takes these projections out over the next 75 years and breaks them into two pieces. The piece that could be attributed to the aging of the population, that's the dark blue piece, and the piece that is above and beyond that, the light blue piece. And I hope it's pretty obvious from the chart, the aging of the population is not the main thing going on here. By 2082, the pure aging of the population, according to these projections, accounts for less than 10% of the projected rise in Medicare and Medicaid spending. If you looked at, and I'm guilty of this, I've written several books on retirement security and Social Security, if you look at the ink that has been spilled on the aging of the population relative to what could help bend that cost growth curve, we are way off in terms of allocating resources towards the true underlying problem. So think tanks, universities, even my esteemed organization, have been over-invested in analyzing options for dealing with the coming retirement of the baby boomers, and substantially under-invested in dealing with ways of trying to bend the excess cost growth curve, which is the key long-term fiscal challenge. So I find it fascinating because the long-term fiscal problem is often described as something that would be solvable if we just locked policymakers in a room and we didn't give them any food and we didn't let them out until they were done. And that actually is pretty insightful for Social Security, because you can take emptying books, and they have, including ones that I've written, and they have lists of options for what will help to reduce the actuarial deficit in Social Security, and you just need to pick and choose from that list, and you're basically done. I have not seen a single credible plan that would restore long-term solvency to Medicare and Medicaid, period. So the thought that you're going to just lock policymakers in the room and let them come up with something, what are they going to be coming up with? There's not been enough work done on what could help bend this curve. So you're going to lock them in the room and they'll never come out, because there is no credible way of solving that problem. So I am very focused. Now, I think some people are excited about that prospect. I'll leave that to the side. I am very focused on trying to significantly dial up the analysis and options that we provide, and that the rest of the sort of policy community provides to policymakers about what could help bend that curve. And I want to note, I think there's a very substantial opportunity embedded in our nation's long-term fiscal challenge, which is, I believe that there is a significant amount of evidence suggesting that we can take costs out of the healthcare system without harming health outcomes. That is to say, I think I have a little illustration, yeah. On the next chart, there is something that some health economists like to call the medical effectiveness curve, which is a relationship between costs and outcomes in the health system. Over some range of costs, as you increase costs, you improve health outcomes, but that curve then flattens out and it might turn down. I believe there is a significant amount of evidence that we're either on the flat part or the downward sloping part of that curve. And that opens up the possibility of taking costs out of the system without harming health outcomes. To calibrate that, when I took office, I appointed a panel of health advisors, which includes lots of the luminary health economists and analysts from across the nation. And one of the things I asked them was, what share of healthcare costs do you believe could be eliminated without reducing quality or harming outcomes? A couple of them weren't willing to answer the question, saying that's ridiculous, but most of them were. And the ones who answered gave answers that range between 5 and 50%, with the most common answer being about 30. 30% of 16% of GDP is about 5% of GDP at no adverse consequences to health. That is so much larger an opportunity or possibility than anything else. I mean, the 2001 and 2003 tax legislation is 2% of the economy, even with an AMT fix. So much larger than anything else that's being discussed, that it is truly remarkable to me that we have spent so little time trying to explore why that's occurring and what could be done about it. So first, let me just try to make the case a little bit for its existence. I think, in my own opinion, the most compelling evidence in favor of that proposition is the very substantial variation that you see in Medicare, in Medicaid, and in the rest of the health system across different parts of the United States in cost per beneficiary that don't correspond to differences in health outcomes. I show you this chart for Medicare spending per capita. There's a group up at Dartmouth, and darker areas of the country have higher spending than lighter areas of the country. A group up at Dartmouth has spent basically its entire professional career trying to explain this variation, and there are novel explanations that are introduced all the time. I gave a speech like this a couple weeks ago, and someone told me the explanation is cloud cover in different parts of the U.S. So I'm sure they and I would welcome other possibilities. But when you try to adjust for the different riskiness of the populations in those different areas, for the cost of building hospitals, for local living costs and what have you, you can explain maybe a third of that variation. So there's a very substantial amount of variation you can't explain. And the kicker to me is, if you go to the next chart, the higher spending areas don't have better health outcomes than the lower spending areas. It's variation like that that does not seem to correspond to differences in health outcomes. And actually, if anything, the simple correlation goes the wrong way. That leads many observers to believe that there are opportunities to reduce costs without harming quality. So then the question becomes, why is this occurring? And before I get to that, I just want to give you a couple other little factoids that will play into the story. This next chart shows you, it may be a little bit difficult to understand, but basically if the dot is near the vertical line, there's not a lot of variation in that thing. And if the dot's far from the vertical line, then there's a lot more variation. And if you look at the things that are known to work, like administering aspirin upon admission for a heart attack at a hospital, there's not a lot of variation across different parts of the United States. Where there's a lot more variation is in more ambiguous situations like diagnostic tests and imaging. So take an MRI, for example. MRIs are clearly extraordinarily beneficial. They've allowed a whole series of diagnoses that we would not have been able to do before their introduction. But that MRI then gets applied in lots of settings where its value in terms of affecting the diagnosis is very questionable. And I have personal experience with this myself, with MRIs being suggested when it was very clear that it basically had almost zero probability of affecting the diagnosis. That story replicated over and over again of an introduction of a technology that's very beneficial, but then it gets applied in lots of settings where it's not that beneficial, therefore drives up costs without improving quality, is a significant part, I believe, of this variation. In other words, the variation you see is much less significant where it's clear what should happen, and much more significant where there's ambiguity about what should happen. And doctor norms and practice norms in different parts of the country vary for reasons that are then not informed by scientific evidence. Very little, and I would say well under half of the medical care delivered in the United States is backed by specific evidence that that intervention works better than this intervention. Most of the evidence that we have, and I know that I'm joined by many from the pharmaceutical industry, which is terrific today, even on pharmaceuticals where there's more testing than in other areas, most of the tests that are done are the drug versus a placebo. They are not drug A versus drug B, and they are not drug A versus drug B versus surgery versus this kind of intervention. There is very little head-to-head comparison of whether this thing works better than that thing, as opposed to whether this thing works better than a sugar pill. And we need a lot more of that if we're going to make sure that we're getting as much value for our healthcare dollar as possible. Now, another thing people note about that chart I showed you is, oh yeah, that's kind of interesting, Dr. Orzag, blah, blah, but the dark areas of that country have academic medical centers. They have the best of the best. And there we go. We had someone who was thinking just that. So let's tackle that right on. And actually, since this is a relatively small group, I can even use the names. Let's look at three of the nation's top medical centers, UCLA Medical, Mass General, and the Mayo Clinic. And let's look at the last 6 months of life for Medicare beneficiaries. So these people are all pretty sick. And that's one way of kind of controlling for severity of cases. If you look at quality indicators, there's not that much variation across these three medical centers. That's the top line. If anything, the Mayo Clinic does a little bit better. But here's the stunning thing. Look at the cost number. Cost at UCLA Medical on average, $50,000 per beneficiary. Mayo Clinic, $26,000. Leads to the obvious question, how can the best medical care in the world cost twice as much as the best medical care in the world? And one of the reasons is that if you then look under the hood a little bit more at physician visits, at the ratio of specialists to primary care physicians, et cetera, there's a lot more stuff going on at Mass General in terms of hospital days, in terms of visits to a physician, than at the Mayo Clinic. And so as an example of this story playing out in repeated, you know, over in many different settings, take hip fractures. If you fracture your hip, you're going to basically be hospitalized. You're in a lot of pain. Any doctor in the world is going to get you into a hospital. There's not that much variation in hip fracture surgery costs or hospitalization costs. Once you're done with that, though, no one can tell you whether it's advisable or beneficial to go visit your doctor four times a month or twice a month or six times a month, sort of post that episode. There's basically no evidence. the variation in follow-up and sort of numbers of visits after that is a significant again. I basically think what happens is, in many parts of the country, including at our top medical centers, we have much more interventionist approaches that are not backed by solid medical evidence and that are accommodated by our fee-for-service system in Medicare, because you get paid more for doing more, that drives up costs without improving quality. And trying to tackle that, given that this is the nation's large, you know, the key to our long-term fiscal challenge, seems like an opportunity that would be worth pursuing. Now, how could that be pursued? I would note that there are a couple things. One obvious approach is to try to build out the information base on what works and what doesn't. And it may well turn out that electronic health records are a key part of that to provide the database for analysis of what works and what doesn't. And the second is then to tie financial incentives, both to providers and consumers, to the information that is created. And on that note, let me deal with consumers first. It is noteworthy that over the past three decades, the share of healthcare expenses coming out of pocket, that is not premiums, but out of pocket co-payments and what have you, has plummeted from 33% in 1975 to about 15% today. All of the available evidence, whether it's from the RAND experiment or the introduction of Medicare or what have you, suggests that as we pay less out of pocket for an additional dollar, we all consume more healthcare and overall spending goes up. So the irony is that we're facing lower cost sharing as consumers, but that drives up costs for all of us, and of course, guess who pays? We all do. It leads to another obvious suggestion, which is, well, why don't we try to increase that cost sharing and capture that opportunity to reduce costs without harming quality? And there is indeed some scope for that. Again, the RAND experiment results suggest that more cost sharing would help to reduce costs without harming quality. But there's also an inherent limit to that kind of approach. And I would note the reason that there's a limit to that approach is my final point, and then I'll take questions, which is that healthcare costs in Medicare, in Medicaid, and in the rest of the health system are very concentrated among a small number of beneficiaries. Medicare, for example, the top 25% of beneficiaries account for 85% of total costs. We as a nation seem unwilling not to provide full insurance or very generous insurance for those catastrophic cases. If we are going to provide full insurance for catastrophic cases, and since catastrophic cases account for such a large share of the total, there's just an inherent limit to the traction you get on the consumer side from more cost sharing, because you're only applying it to a small share of total costs. And so a caution on the consumer side is not that it's not helpful to have more cost sharing from the perspective of reducing costs, and there are obviously other perspectives one can bring to bear on that question, but rather don't expect miracles, because you're going to be applying that cost sharing to a pretty small base. And that leads many observers to say that ultimately we do need to alter the incentives facing providers in the healthcare system away from what Mark McClellan calls a fee-for-service system towards a fee-for-value system, and paying providers more for providing higher value care and less for providing lower value care, because there's an inherent limit in terms of the traction you get on the consumer side. So with that, I guess I will open it up for questions. I know I covered a lot of territory and hopefully didn't exhaust you. Thank you very much. Questions, back there. Yes, a good part of my year has been spent on Medicare, traditional Medicare versus Medicare Advantage, so let me talk about that a little bit. As you all know, Medicare Advantage plans are the private plans within Medicare that beneficiaries can sign up for. Almost 20% of beneficiaries are now in Medicare Advantage plans. The theory behind Medicare Advantage was that by creating managed care organizations as part of Medicare, you could deliver coordinated care, disease management, and other things. The fastest growing part of Medicare Advantage has been private fee-for-service plans, where that care coordination and those other aspects of managed care are less salient. Our estimates, along with estimates from MedPAC, which is the official entity that advises the Congress on Medicare policy, suggest that the cost per beneficiary in a Medicare Advantage plan is about 12% higher than enrolling that beneficiary in traditional fee-for-service. And there are proposals to offset other policy changes by reducing those payment rates. I would note that one consequence of reducing the payment rate is that you would reduce the attractiveness of Medicare Advantage plans to beneficiaries and to the firms offering them, and the result would be lower enrollment in them. And I know that's of concern to some policymakers. Another aspect of this is many of the Medicare Advantage plans are basically, you can think of that 12% payment almost as a public subsidy, well, it is a public subsidy for the things that Medicare Advantage plans deliver to beneficiaries in the form of additional benefits, in the form of reduced premiums, in the form of additional benefits like care coordination and disease management. And from that perspective, a flaw in the existing system is we are not requiring enough information from the plans to report back on what's working and what's not. So if you think of what's happening as sort of a little experiment in which we're paying the plans to go out and do stuff and see whether, you know, having a nurse practitioner works or this works or that works, it would seem to me advisable to, in exchange for those public funds, be obtaining more information about the results. And I know many of the insurance plans are now gathering data that could be useful in evaluating the results of their various activities, but that would seem to be one potential perspective on what's happening. Beyond that, as you probably know, there are various legislative proposals to change payment rates for all Medicare Advantage plans, to change them just for private fee-for-service plans. And there are differential effects across different parts of the United States from those different kinds of approaches. Over here.
Before becoming a tax lawyer, I pretended to be an economist and epidemiologist and actually worked at RAND on the health insurance study, showing the relationship between cost sharing and the quality of medical care.
Right.
That was 29 years ago. Why is it that we're still asking the same questions?
Well, that's a very good question, and actually, there was just I was recently involved in a discussion about whether we needed RAND 2, but because of so many changes in the medical system since then, and because it didn't include the elderly and what have you. But I think one of the reasons that we're still asking the same questions is the difficulty of tackling it. You know, some people say we don't actually have a healthcare system because it's so disjoint. And the response to that is, if you think we don't have a healthcare system, just try changing it. The political economy of changing the healthcare system seems to me way above my pay grade, and I will not try to tackle that larger issue. But just to say, it does seem to me that in terms of like CBO's role and the role of other analysts, there is insufficient information. The RAND experiment is very clear, and it's great that we have it in terms of cost sharing, but there's too little work on some of the other things that I was discussing to know. And another thing is, you know, even the results of the RAND experiment, as terrific as they were, there have been questions raised. That was a randomized experiment done within a basically fixed medical system. And as you may know, the results that have been done from a non-randomized setting involving comparisons of the introduction of Medicare, which had differential effects across different parts of the United States, which then affected the overall way that medicine was practiced, suggests much larger responsiveness than even came out of the RAND experiment. So even on the narrow question of cost sharing, there still is some question about the exact magnitude, but I don't think there's any question that cost sharing affects healthcare demand and what consumers do, in part because of that outstanding study.
Going back to your opening comments about the corporate tax revenue.
Yes, sir.
Curious, surely you've thought about the that one-year window that allowed for repatriation.
Yes, sir.
Our
estimates and the estimates from the Joint Committee of Taxation, suggest that that's only a small player in this story. And again, one reason, beyond just the simple accounting that is done, one reason for suspecting that that may be a small part of the story is this overall increase in profit shares that you see across different parts of the world, which would be a little inconsistent with a story in which what's happening is just shifting of profits that would have accrued in some other setting to the U.S. So it's there, but it's not. It does not appear to be a huge part, and nowhere near the kinds of magnitudes that we're talking about. Well, a couple of things. One is, again, coming back to the observation that healthcare costs are very concentrated. They are, and they are disproportionately concentrated among people who have multiple chronic diseases. And that leads to an obvious area of exploration, which is, can you do anything about those high-cost cases? But I would just come back to the same observation. It is very similar to, you know, the example I gave you of the three top medical centers. Those were for Medicare beneficiaries in the last 6 months of their lives, the majority of whom have, by that point, multiple chronic conditions. And so there is a significant overlap between the stories. The other thing I would say is it's often very difficult to look specifically at what works to reduce those costs. So people often say, we just need to coordinate care, that will reduce costs. The Medicare program, CMS, is now conducting a whole variety of pilot projects on trying different things, and to their credit, I think that's terrific. But the early results are not that encouraging for things that we intuitively think will work. So for example, there's a coordinated care demonstration project. The early results from that project suggest that if anything, at least the form of coordinated care that they have embodied in that project, if anything, raises costs rather than reducing it for seriously ill patients. Obviously not the result that the people who were designing the project were hoping for. And it may be that they're just not doing enough of it, or they're not doing it aggressively enough. Similarly, on disease management, there is a lot of talk about disease management in terms of reducing costs, and I hold out the hope that that is indeed the case, but the conditions for which it has been shown to reduce costs as opposed to perhaps improve the quality of life for beneficiaries are unfortunately very narrow. So I guess on a lot of the chronic conditions, I'm in the mode of intuition suggests something's got to be feasible there to reduce costs, and it is where a lot of the money is. But the specific policy and interventions that actually work are, I think, unfortunately talked about more than actually shown to be rigorously the case. And we are open to evidence on things that actually work, because I am very eager to be able to show policymakers, here are the, you know, 10 or 15 or 20 different things that could actually help to reduce costs, because I'm often in the frustrating position of saying, I know we all think that, but unfortunately, the evidence isn't there, and so we can't score any savings. Sir?
Is there data on the percentage of healthcare costs associated with the last 6 months of life? And if so, does that have implications on the ability to control those costs for patients who are dying?
Yes. Medicare costs, for example, about 25% of the total is for Medicare beneficiaries in the last 6 months of life. So clearly very disproportionate among the end of life. And by the way, that's one reason why the demographic thing is not as big a player as you'd think. Because I'll just do a sort of reductio ad absurdum here, which is not true, but it's got an element of truth in it, which is think of a world in which basically we're healthy, in which, so therefore your health costs are low, and then you get really sick, your healthcare costs go way up, and you die. I know it's a pretty depressing thought, but stay with me for a minute. If you extend life expectancy, so the population gets older, you still have that you get sick and die thing, but you're adding more years of low healthcare costs, and that's one reason why the demographic effect is not as big as you would think. Because basically the evidence suggests that life expectancy increases or mortality rate declines technically have been associated with morbidity improvements also. So we're living longer and living healthier years rather than having more high cost years. And that's one reason why the demographics don't exert as large an effect as you would think. This is something that we're very actively looking at. Let me tell you, share a couple of thoughts. I believe the largest return to health information technology will come if it's part of an overall system of using that data to evaluate what works and what doesn't, and then to tie incentives and behavior to it. And just putting in an HIT system by itself is not likely to lead to large efficiency improvements in the absence of other structural changes. There are many people who believe, based on some studies that have been done, that those internal efficiencies are very substantial. We have been very carefully reviewing those studies, and you will not see CBO scores for health IT by itself suggesting very large savings there. And that brings me to a broader point, which is something, coming back to the RAND experiment, I think it's very likely that if we're actually going to build out the information base on, you know, is the MRI warranted for a marathon running policy wonk who clearly works too hard or not, or, you know, for this kind of subset, we're going to have to use panel data, that is data on lots of hopefully electronic health records that is then analyzed using statistical techniques, which are imperfect. You try to control for everything you can control for and tease out causation from observed correlations. And the medical profession is going to have to live with the imperfections associated with panel data econometrics at exactly the same time that the economics field, having struggled with those imperfections and partially throwing up its hands at it, and with the exception of the RAND experiment, having done very little randomized experimentation in the past, is moving in the opposite direction towards doing more randomized experiments. But I think the medical profession is going to have to, out of necessity, give up its insistence that only randomized control trials are kind of useful as standards of information, because you simply cannot do enough randomized control trials with big enough samples to study the various things that need to be done. And therefore, we have to rely on the lower level of imperfect statistical analysis of data sets that on, you know, electronic health records. Electronic health records will provide a lot more information than insurance claims currently do, and that existing information does. Any other? All right. Oh, what? One more. Last question.
I recently listened to a tape of a speech that Milton Friedman gave in the last year of his life.
Uh-huh.
And the speech was actually about the education system, but he drew parallels to the healthcare
yes.
system as being basically a socialist system in which the consumer doesn't pay for the product and therefore doesn't make a judgment about the cost effectiveness of the product. Is that part of the reason that we've got a problem, an economic problem in the healthcare system, which is, you know, vital, but the food production is vital too, and you don't have a similar problem in the food production system?
I think there are two main reasons. One, for why we are where we are. One is that the financial incentives are messed up, and that's both on the consumer side and the producer side. On the consumer side, as I already said, we're at 15% of healthcare costs coming out of pocket. And if on the margin you're paying 15 cents or less for that additional dollar, you have less incentive to care about whether you go and do the test or you know, spend an extra day doing the imaging or what have you. And on the provider side, we are still, especially in our public programs, disproportionately fee-for-service, which means you do more stuff, you get paid more. I'll come to litigation in a second. I know that's a hot topic. I'll come to that in a second. And the second thing is we don't have enough evidence on what works and what doesn't. So moving towards pay for performance, for example, or thinking that consumers will be able to choose to do this versus that, has the limit or the limitation that you don't know. So if I had full cost sharing and I had to choose whether to do this test or that test or this drug versus that drug, you don't have enough information to be able to make that choice well. So thinking that you'll just that all you need to do is unleash the power of incentives, that's obviously very important, but you also need an information base which is currently not in existence and will take time to develop, or currently not in existence to a sufficient enough degree. Now, you asked about litigation. Before I took over at CBO, CBO put out an analysis on the impact of medical liability laws in different states on healthcare costs. The conclusion from that study was that that effect, while it was there, seemed to be pretty modest, which is in direct contradiction to the views of pretty much every doctor that you ever speak to. And I think one of the reasons is that while the direct effect statistically might be small, it may well play into the phenomenon I was just describing, which is if it's not clear what you should do, and your doctor down the hall is doing all the tests, and you're worried you're going to get sued if you don't, then you do it. And so the existence of that liability system may perpetuate and reinforce the existence of social norms among doctors. So if the guy down the hall or the woman down the hall is not doing that, then it's okay not to do it. And one of, I think, the great benefits of substantially expanding, you know, if we had an Institute of Medicine comparative effectiveness entity or some other entity or entities that was doing a lot more comparative effectiveness research, it's almost like you provide a safe harbor to the doctors to say, I was following the recommended care. I was not seeing you six times a month because you know what? The Institute of Medicine study on that topic said two times a month was the most effective care. Right now, you don't have that defense. You don't have that, what is a reasonable practice? The reasonable practice is whatever the other physicians in your area are presumably doing, and it reinforces that social norm, which again is not backed by scientific evidence, and then increases cost. Now, one solution to that might be medical liability changes. The other solution is to provide those safe harbors that, you know, more information could help, and I'll let you judge which is more difficult to achieve from a political economy perspective. All right, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.